Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black Arts and Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. We are joined in the studio by filmmaker Jed. Is it Rothstein, Jed?
Yes. Hi, Wanda. How are you?
I'm good. I'm glad it worked out. We were, you know, going back and forth. Your film is simply fantastic. Before the spring,
so
after
much.
The fall. Yeah, just finished watching it.
Nice way to wake up, I suppose, for early Saturday morning.
Yes. Great film to start one's day off.
Thank
with.
You so much.
Yeah, and congratulations on the national broadcast today on ITVS.
Thank you. Yeah, tomorrow night, actually, Sunday night at 10.
Oh, Sunday night. Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Sunday night at 10 on the World Channel, the PBS World Channel, which you have to go to worldchannel.org to find out what number it is in your area. It's a little complicated, but it'll be there, and it'll also be on PBS.org video for a couple of weeks, streaming for free, so people can catch it.
Yeah, that's a really nice, that's a new, I guess, opportunity that PBS has been offering for the last few years, right?
That's right, yeah. It's a great way for, I mean, I think obviously everyone's viewing habits have changed and people, we all sort of watch whatever we want when it's convenient for us, so it's a great way to see it
at
your leisure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to tell our audience a little bit about you, and then we could tell them what the film's about. You were nominated for an Academy Award for your 2010 film, A Killing in the Name. What's that about, Killing in the Name?
Killing in the Name is the story of a man named Ashraf Al-Khalid, who is a Jordanian man whose wedding was attacked by Al-Qaeda suicide bombers in 2005, and he lost 27 members of his family, but he and his wife survived, and he went on a mission around the world to meet with extremist groups and militant jihadists and try to convince them to resolve their problems nonviolently and really to speak as a Muslim, to speak within the Muslim community about resolving problems nonviolently. And so I went on this journey with him, and it was pretty incredible. He's a very brave man, and I think he felt after he had already survived this terrible attack, he really wasn't afraid of anything. So I had to steel myself to go with him into some pretty crazy places. But it's the story of his efforts to basically open a dialogue about peaceful disagreement, nonviolent disagreement.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, and your earlier work includes producing the award-winning documentary Shouting Fire, Stories from the Edge of Free Speech, which premiered at the Dance Film Festival in 2009. So where was this shot?
Well, this was it was a great film. Liz Garbus is the director, and she's a longtime friend and colleague of mine. And we wanted to make a film about the history of the First Amendment and the history of free speech in America, which is, we both felt and I still feel, is a very sort of the central defining virtuous characteristic of our government is this elevation of the right to say what you want to say about whatever you want, and really from that, all other freedom flows. So the film follows a number of different stories of people really on the front lines of battles over free speech, because it's something that is never assured. It always needs to be contested. It's something that we are given the right to continue to fight for, essentially. And so we filmed with professors in Colorado who was being challenged over some things that he had said after 9/11 that were very controversial. We followed the story of a school teacher in New York who was being drummed out of starting the first Arabic language school in the public school system here because some people objected to her alleged statements, which I think in the end weren't even actual statements of hers, on some topics. We filmed with protesters against the Republican National Convention here in New York in 2004. We filmed also with people on the very conservative side of the spectrum who are also arguing for free speech. A young man and a high school student in Southern California who was prevented from going to school because he had an anti-homosexuality slogan on his T-shirt. It's really interesting in the First Amendment stories. You get in, you really see where the traditional ideological lines break down because people on the far ends of the spectrum and either side are really share this reverence for the right to say what they want to say. So it was a really interesting journey through that world of free speech and of people really risking a lot to maintain it in our country.
Yeah, that seems to be a theme in your films, people's rights to exercise their free speech, as well as sort of the idea of democratic governments.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been drawn to the idea of freedom and democracy and freedom of thought as an ongoing part of the human experience and something that is never, we can enshrine it in law and we can proclaim its importance, but it needs to be lived by all of us and needs to be fought for and maintained on an ongoing basis. And to me, the journeys that people have had around the world to do that are really very inspiring to me. So I like to find those stories and tell them. I did one about journalists on the front lines of the same type of battle all over the world, in Russia, in Sierra Leone, in Mexico, here in the United States. It's always, to me, I find it very inspiring because people are, it's always easier to sit back and not make noise and not raise your head and not risk anything, especially in countries where doing so could get you killed or get you jailed for a very, very long time, like the main characters in Before the Spring. Ayman Nour, when I first met the Nour family, Ayman Nour had been the first person to run against Hosni Mubarak for the presidency in 2005, very much on this platform of freedom, democracy, openness. And he was not only defeated in an election that was pretty dubious or whose fairness was pretty dubious, but he was then charged with these ridiculous charges of forging ballot and forging his ballot signatures to get on the ballot and was jailed in a terrible, terrible prison. And he was a political prisoner when I met the boys and when I met their mother, Camila. And everyone in, not everyone, but many, many people in Egypt at that time were afraid to go out and protest against Mubarak. They were afraid to even criticize him publicly. But this family, the Nours and Gamila Ismail, were completely fearless, even as their father and husband was sitting in terrible, terrible prison conditions. They were out in the streets chanting, down, down Mubarak, they and some other courageous activists who worked alongside them. And I think you've seen this in the sad story. I mean, the story of the title of the film really charts, unfortunately, the journey of the story, which is it starts before the revolution. You see the promise and the hope of the revolution, and then you see the complexities of it, and now the at least the failure of this initial phase, and that the more or less the old regime is back, except in worse form. But you still see the courage of people like the Nours and Hossam al-Hamlawi, who is one of the people we speak with in the film, who are just undaunted and fearless and continue to speak up for everyone's rights and continue to call out the government when they overstep, which is very often. I mean, they're locking up thousands of people with no charges. I'm sure you followed the trials where they've sentenced 500 people to death in absentia. I mean, these are really egregious cases, but people of courage and people of conscience in Egypt continue to work to bring their country to a better place. And those stories are what motivate me to, telling those stories is what motivates me as a filmmaker, because I think they're so inspiring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when I was watching the film, I was wondering how you were strategically in these great spots. And I'm like, particularly when there were like the aerial shots of the people in the square. And I was wondering how many cameras did you have, and it seemed, you know, also dangerous. So I was wondering, did you use archival footage, or did you have multiple cameras? Like, how did you do? I mean, it was just really, you know, like it's because, you know, you're profiling this family and they're taking us through. It's a real personal journey through the revolution. You know, before the spring, the Arab Spring, and after the fall. I love the, you know, particularly when you had the two frames juxtaposed. You had the last one that really stood out was when the president was giving, President Mubarak was giving his speech. And then you had Noor, the older son, and other people listening.
They weren't watching it, actually. They were listening, but.
Yeah, okay.
They weren't able to watch it in the square, but they were able to listen to it on a very crackly speaker. It was a combination of all those things that you mentioned. Film is a very collaborative art form, so I had amazing collaborators, people that came there with me from New York, and Egyptians that I met there who were incredible. Bashir Wage, who's an Egyptian cameraman that I befriended when he basically saved my life at one point in the early part of the revolution, ended up shooting a good chunk of the film, and he got some amazing footage during different parts of the uprising and was able to get up high and down low. Mark Levine, who is one of the producers of the film and who wrote the book Heavy Metal Islam, on which the film was, or by which the film was inspired, on which it's based, got some footage from one of the apartments high above the square. We did get a little archival footage, certainly, that we spliced in there and tried to make seamless. We had a great team of fearless cinematographers. I shot a little bit of it myself. Tom Hurwitz was our main cinematographer, did some amazing work. The process of making the film is combining every element that you can get to tell the best story. And so, that's what we did, and especially in this film, more so than others that I've made, because the circumstances were dangerous and it was hard to move around and it was hard to get in and out, we really had to rely on a lot of different video formats and different people to piece together one solid story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, the scenes in the home, yeah. I don't know how many people, the viewers, will have been in a home of an Arab in Egypt, and when you look at it, it's like it could be anywhere. It doesn't have to. I mean, it could be in New York. It could be in California.
Definitely the Noors are certainly, as you can see from the film, they're much more fortunate than a lot of Egyptians who live on pretty meager incomes. But they have an apartment in Zamalek that's pretty striking. And it was ended up being a great place to meet and film a lot. You can also see, I think when I set out to make the film, and this was before there was any thought of a revolution, the idea was really to show young people struggling for the right to play the music that they wanted to play. These were kids who played heavy metal. The music was frowned upon and in many cases banned. And the idea was to follow the story of these young kids struggling for the right to free expression, which, you know, as you pointed out, is something I really like to focus on. And by doing so, show that young people all over the world are sort of the same, and that they just want to have the freedom to determine their own future and to shape the world as they grow into it. And that desire is really universal and can be something that brings us all together rather than pushes us apart. And I think that drove the film, that drove the choice of who to follow and the fact that their struggles expanded from fighting for the right to play the kind of music they wanted to play to fighting for the future of their country and for their survival was something that made the journey even more intense, but it didn't change the basic principle of it. I mean, they were going for the same thing, for freedom from the beginning, and the stakes just got higher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So tell us a little bit more about Mark Levine and his book Heavy Metal Islam. Is Mark Levine a friend of yours? Is that how you found out
Mark
about?
Well, Mark is definitely a friend of mine now. We went through a lot together, and I love Mark. He's great, mm-hmm. and he's really fearless. And he spent a lot of time in Egypt, a lot of time all over the region, and has really opened my eyes to a lot of really fascinating things. I actually met Mark. You were asking earlier about Shouting Fire. And when we were shooting Shouting Fire, we went out to L.A. to do a number of interviews. And one of the stories that we were following was about a book that listed the 101 most dangerous professors in America who tended to be sort of people who were critical of America's Middle Eastern policy. And Mark, and we were interviewing the author of the book, David Horowitz, and I thought, well, we should interview some of these dangerous professors. So I literally opened the book and looked around and thought, oh, here's four or five of them that are at universities in the Los Angeles area. And I just called them up, and Mark was the one who was willing to, I said, hey, you're a really dangerous professor. You want to come talk to us? And so he came up. He's a professor at UC Irvine. He came up to L.A. where we were filming in a studio and had a great interview, and he and I really hit it off. We ended up not using his segment in that film, but he mentioned to me at the time that he had a manuscript about to be published called Heavy Metal Islam, Rock Rebellion. I'm going to mangle the title because I always mangle the subtitle. Rock Rebellion and Revolution.
Rock Rebellion and Revolution. And the Struggle for the Soul of Islam.
Mm-hmm. Right, you got it. That's better. And he thought it might be an interesting film, and so we talked some more, and we ended up getting interest from a French production company, Bon Pioche, and a producer there named Alison Luchak, who was also really instrumental in making this whole film happen. And we decided to film in three countries. His book covers many countries and wasn't really practical for a film, but we decided we were going to film in Morocco, Egypt, and Iran. And this was in 2008. And we got enough money to start, and we had to choose one country. And I thought, well, Morocco is kind of too easy. It's too, you know, people go there and go to music festivals and smoke hash and play music and follow in the steps of Jimmy Page, and that's all really nice, but there's not a lot of conflict or struggle in that. It's just kind of a nice journey. So let's not do that one first. And Iran was just heading into one of its many very repressive phases, and I thought, you know, this seems a little too hard for the first shoot because we don't even have the ability to get into the country very easily, and I think at the time they were actually expelling even foreign reporters. So I thought, Egypt sounds great. It's got a great history. It kind of meshes with the imagery kind of meshes with the classical imagery of heavy metal. And it's the music is banned there. It's kind of repressed, but at the same time, it's not so impossible for us to operate. You know, we can go in there. We can meet people. The people that Mark had written about, the Noors among them, the young women in a group called Massive Scar Era, who are also in the film, they're really not in this PBS version, unfortunately, but they're in a longer festival version of the film, and they're the first all-female metal band in Egypt. We went and met them, and I was really taken by all of the people I met, by the Noors, by Hassam, who's an incredible journalist and chronicler of the heavy metal scene, by Shireen and Massive Scar Era, Shady and Noor, of course. And so it kind of gradually happened that they filled up my entire mind's eye of the story, and we ended up just deciding to focus on Egypt. But Mark's book really goes into the spread of this type of music, of heavy metal, throughout the Muslim world and its implications for youth culture and in a region of the world where very heavily weighted demographically towards young people. And he really, in some ways, was very prescient in predicting the types of changes that might sweep over the region, not so much because of heavy metal, but heavy metal was, in a way, was a sort of canary in the coal mine that showed that young people had this desire to speak out, to be different, to challenge the existing norms and really to risk something for it. I think in a lot of ways the book is very prescient in predicting a lot of things that ended up happening in the ensuing years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really, your film is exciting and it sort of takes the viewer on an emotional ride as we wonder what's going to happen, you know, to the newer family when Iman is arrested and then you show us, you know, evidence of him being tortured, and then his wife runs for office, Gamila Ismail, and what happens there
people could do an entire film about Gamila, by the way. She's an absolutely incredible woman, and she's my admiration for her work is, you know, without limit. I mean, she is, you know, she, in the midst of all this, when her husband was in prison and she had these two teenage sons, in the midst of taking over the mantle of their political party and continuing that struggle, even as they had been jailed, she was firebombed out of their offices. The thugs working for Mubarak firebombed the offices while she was in it, while she and her staff were in the offices. And this is a scene in the film, actually, and they escaped. And then she was charged with arson. So the government not only tried to kill her, but they then went after her. And she was completely undaunted. She also really, it was very important to her to maintain the dream and the idea of freedom and openness and wonderment for her young sons. And in the midst of being hunted by this repressive government, she managed to do that. And she managed to impart these ideas to them. And a couple years later, as the film continued on, because it really covers this period of 4 years of an incredible period in the life of that country, an incredible period in the life of this family, the boys really matured into these values that she had instilled in them, despite everything that she had to endure. And she, when she runs for the assembly, the election was, we actually filmed the election, and it was completely chaotic. There were secret police ringing the polls, and ballot boxes that were stolen, and people running through the streets. I mean, it was really did not have the appearance. I'm not a professional election watcher, but it really did not have the appearance to me of a very legitimate poll. And at the end of that, this is now December of 2010, about 6 weeks before the uprising, the January 25th revolution started, Noor and Shady and Hassam and various other people in the film said to me, as I was in interviews just after the election, just before I left, they said, this just can't go on. We're fed up. We need a revolution. I mean, this is literally what they were saying. And 6 weeks later, it happened. It started happening. So it was an incredibly tense and scary and amazing period of history to witness. And I hope that we were able to capture it in the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think you were able to capture it. And it's just, it seemed, you know, from the babies on up to the adults, everyone was in agreement that change needed to happen. You know, the shots of the children with the flags and the peace signs. It's just really, really beautiful.
Yes, yeah. I mean, the sadness that I have, and I'm sure that everyone in the film in Egypt has it to a much more profound extent, is that this outpouring of courage and strength and goodwill was kind of first hijacked by the political organization of the Brotherhood, who had also been repressed for different reasons than the Noors, but had nonetheless been repressed for many years by the Mubarak regime. They had the political organization to kind of come in and secure the gains or solidify the gains that the protesters had wrought. But then they began to, when they actually took power, they began to rule in a way that didn't engender a lot of support beyond their base. And I think that obviously that was a mistake on their part. But now we're sort of back at, we're back behind square one. It was like two or three steps forward and four steps back. The regime now is more ruthless in many ways than Mubarak, or at least than late period Mubarak, and they're less constrained because at a certain point Mubarak had sort of wormed his way into polite society in the world and was at least on the face of things occasionally trying to play the good guy, although certainly he wasn't doing that behind the scenes, but he was at least sometimes trying to do the right, to appear to do the right thing. And I think now General Sisi and the new regime have no incentive to do that. They are backed by this perception that if they didn't come in and take over, there would be complete chaos, and therefore they have a license to be as ruthless as they want to be, to lock up people. You can be locked up for protesting the right that you can't protest. You can be sentenced to long prison terms in secret trials with no evidence that last 37 seconds. Noor is in a group called No Military Trials because his friends are getting swooped up by the hundreds and by the thousands and locked away. I mean, it's become an incredibly repressive and scary atmosphere. There are journalists, in fact, Mark and I have an op-ed piece on AlJazeera.com today that tells some of the story behind the film. And it was inspired by what happened to some of our colleagues, or I mean, in the largest sense, colleagues as journalists and storytellers, who were given 7- and 10-year sentences for charges that are completely absurd, that they were helping the Muslim Brotherhood foment social discord or chaos. Just, there's really nothing, there's no limit anymore to what the government can do, and it's very sad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as we watch Shadi, you know, become more politicized, and then you know, his little brother, you know, sort of commenting on it, and then their mother, it makes you feel really nervous, particularly when they are arrested or picked up, and there's a journalist in the group, and he is recording what's he doesn't know where he's going, but he's sort of talking about what's going on with them.
Noor was picked up.
Yeah.
The journalist from The Guardian, the British paper.
Oh. Okay.
And he was in the truck with Noor, and he managed to keep his wits about him and his phone and record this journey. It was really extraordinary that he was able to do that. It was very early in the whole revolution. And Noor, again, you can see from that clip that Noor was completely fearless. He's a young kid at this point. He's 18 or 19 years old. And he's being trucked out to the desert, which is where they would frequently take people and beat them to smithereens or jail them. And he knew this is where the truck was going. And at a certain point, the guards determined that the son of Ayman Noor was in the truck and that his being there might cause this to get more attention than they wanted to. So they wanted to just take him out of the truck. And they kept opening the door and shouting, "Noor, Noor, get out of the truck." And he refused to leave because he knew that by his being there, people would follow the truck, pay attention to it, and try to get them all out. And it was it was a feeling that, you know, they were all in it together, even when he had this opportunity to sort of get out of it. And I think it just demonstrates this incredible courage that Noor has, that he still has. And I saw him do this time and again, even after I left. He would put himself in harm's way without regard for his own safety in order to help other people and then in order to further this greater goal of helping his country get freedom. Noor is an incredible, incredible young man. And I think it wouldn't surprise me if someday he's running the show over there. Certainly make me happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So is there a soundtrack to accompany the film?
There's a soundtrack that Mark put out with the book called Flowers in the Desert, which is great, with a number of the bands that are in the film. Mm-hmm. We don't have a soundtrack exclusively for the film, but I would direct people towards that, Flowers in the Desert. It's got a number of the bands in the film. It's got a number of bands that we filmed with at different points who, for various editing reasons, didn't make it into the final film, but who are great. Beyond the East in particular is a band I really loved, and they're in there. Massive Scar Era, who the all-women's metal band that are in the feature version of the film, are in there. Shady's in there, some of Noor's bands. So I would recommend people check that out. I think it's on iTunes places that you can buy records.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or download and music.
Right. And there is on the ITVS, the ORG films, Before the Spring and After the Fall, there's information about the film and about, you know, times for the screenings. Is there a website for the film independent of ITVS?
There is. You can go to Insurgent Media, insurgentmedianewyork.com. And then the easiest way to get up-to-date information is to just go to the film's Facebook page, which is just Before the Spring, After the Fall at Facebook. If you just search for it, it's right there. And we have information about broadcast, screenings. The film will be put out through iTunes and Amazon later this summer, so that'll all be up there on the Before the Spring, After the Fall Facebook page.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you have a couple of more minutes?
Sure.
Okay. I wanted to ask you about sort of your training and in this type of filmmaking. Sounds like you went sort of to like this, to like a boot camp for insurgency kind of shooting and training, because all of your films are like really pushing the edge. We didn't even mention all of them. You've got your television documentaries, Coma and Democracy on Deadline, and then you won a Seeing Golden Eagle for your work as co-producer of Pandemic, Facing AIDS, and
right.
an Emmy for your work on Kids Behind Bars, 2002.
Right. Well, I studied anthropology in college. I actually went to college. Uh-huh. You're in Oakland, right?
Yes,
So I went to Cal for college, to Berkeley.
Oh,
and
okay.
I studied anthropology there and actually got into ethnographic film. Had some great professors there. And they really opened my eyes to the power of telling stories about different people in different communities in the world and how that can be a tool to bring us together. And so I got really inspired by that study from an anthropological perspective and decided that the way I wanted to pursue it was through film. And so I started that there. I then went to film school back here in New York, Columbia, for more dramatic, traditional film school. But ended up doing that for a couple of years and then leaving to go back into documentaries and just started working in documentaries here in New York and got in with some great producers at Lumiere Productions and Moxie Firecracker with Liz Garbus and Rory Kennedy, who were real mentors for me, and ended up having some great opportunities to work on films that really took me around the world and took me behind the scenes of some scary and amazing places. And I think each time you learn something different, you learn about how you how you have to meet people on the ground level and sort of meet people on their own terrain when you go in somewhere, and really recognize that you're, it's not about you and it's not about what you think should happen. It's really about getting into understanding somebody else's space and somebody else's needs, and then trying to work with them to tell their stories. And I think you can, that's a knowledge and a skill that hopefully I can continue to apply across all sorts of different disciplines. I'm doing a film now called 10 Questions You Can't Ask About Israel and Palestine. So I'm getting into kind of dicey topics again, but I'm trying to approach them from this level of really hearing people's own stories in their own words, and having open eyes and an open mind when I go into things. I don't really, to me, it's interesting to tell people stories and to see where they go and to learn what I learn, and rather than to have a sort of polemical idea that I want to convince everyone that they need to do this or that. I'm much more interested in the journey and learning through it and through the process of telling the story, learning new things and new perspectives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for your current film that you're working on, 10 Questions, are you traveling to these two countries?
I will be, yeah. Right now we're shooting domestically. A lot of it is based in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Later in the late summer or early fall, probably we'll be heading back to the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. Have you been to Palestine before?
I have, yeah. Actually, for Democracy on Deadline, we filmed all over Israel and Palestine, both sides of the Green Line and Israel proper, and in Gaza and in the West Bank, and I met some really fascinating people there, some of whom hopefully I'll revisit when I go back.
Oh, that's excellent. That's excellent. And just reading further in your bio, it says that, besides living in New York, that you have a wife who's a writer.
I do, yes.
Myra Jacob, and you have a son. I don't know how old he is.
He's five.
He's five. So he's young. Okay.
Yeah. Actually, when this film was starting, when Before the Spring, After the Fall, or what became called Before the Spring, After the Fall was starting, I decided to do it to pursue something that was less risky than some of these other things I had done, because our son had just been born, and I promised my wife that, you know, this is going to be really tame. It's just going to film these guys having a big battle of the bands in Cairo, and, you know, it's really just this totally different thing than going into these crazy war zones. It's really calm, and it'll be, you know, it'll be over in a few weeks, and of course that didn't happen.
Isn't that amazing? You know, what you thought it was and what, ended up being something else. However, just from what you had done in the past, you were prepared. Isn't that fabulous?
Yeah, I mean, as prepared as one can be, you're never totally prepared. And it was, you know, Mark, we really tag-teamed. I was there for half of it, and Mark was there for half, or in terms of the actual days of the revolution, we managed to get it all covered between Mark and I and Bashir, who was our great collaborator in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
It's an amazing journey. It's really hard to make documentaries well, and it's always a difficult financial environment for them. It was great of ITVS to come in and give us finishing funds and give us a broadcast. We were really grateful for that. But it's, you know, you keep coming back to it because it's just such a exciting journey and sort of an exciting path through life, and hopefully I'll find some way to keep doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how has the film been received in Egypt?
It's been difficult to arrange a big screening there because of everything that's going on. The people who are in the film, most of them anyway, have seen it and really love it. And we're still planning on having a big screening there, but we haven't yet because of the difficult situation, but we are putting one together. And I'm interested to see how it plays in a large setting.
Yeah, yeah. And how is the Noor family doing? You tell us at the end of the film, you know, that Mrs. Noor has a has a television show, and she's really...
Well, Gamila,
like,
I should
really...
mention Gamila and Iman separated.
Oh, they did? Oh.
Yeah, it wasn't really that germane to the story, but at some point in the... couple years ago, they separated. So they're... Anyway, that's not the point of the story, but they're you know, apart. Gamila, I think her show ended. She remains politically active. Iman remains politically active. And again, very courageous, you know, trying to stay true to his values in the midst of these swirling political currents where, you know, 1 minute one party's in power and 1 minute the next, and each time they're going to lock everybody up who doesn't agree with them. And to really stick to your principles, as he has done, I think is very admirable, even if, you know, there are people within the film who, for whom Iman Nur's political positions are not their own. And I mean, certainly Hossam, the journalist and activist, would say that Iman is not radical enough and is not the right answer. But I think all of them respect his sticking to his guns. And Hossam is still writing and blogging and being very active in the democracy movement. Nur has become an environmental activist, which is great in a way. I think it's it allows him to do something of critical importance and to use his organizing skills. And maybe I don't know if he sees it this way, but from afar, I would say, you know, it takes him a little bit out of the range of constant fire that is aimed at the activists. I mean, literally sometimes and metaphorically all the time. Shady is playing music again, DJing and playing acoustic music. His band broke up. Your Prince Harming broke up. Mm-hmm. But the family is, they're still there. They're still fighting for their values and fighting for Egypt. And, you know, it's an increasingly difficult atmosphere in which to do that. And as they see their friends getting locked up, and there's no reason that they couldn't go back to that situation themselves. So it's real bravery for them to continue on.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Wonderful, wonderful film. And, you know, I've seen other films about this particular period. But this one here, I mean, it's really interesting how you could take a story that people think they know and then show it from a different angle. And it's always really wonderful, you know, going, you know, with the personal and then showing, you know, the micro connection to the macro, which is wonderful, because we can identify with this family and these young people and them trying to, well, first, you know, we meet them as artists. and you know,
definitely.
We hear about how, you know, art is political, and then, you know, it's really great the way you would shoot Noor talking about a song and then have the song, you know, be the soundtrack for the opening scene, you know, that's coming, that, and it's sort of speaking to whatever we're looking at. That was very well.
Yeah. Well, I definitely felt like the music spoke to their situation, and I wanted to let the music guide the story and at least inform, undergird it emotionally, and I hope it was able to do that. A lot of their early music is not political, but it's inspired by the limits that were placed on them. And in a way, I think it's sort of this personal political statement, even if it's not making overt political statements. Mm-hmm. It's making statements about their aspirations and their desire for freedom. And so to me, that putting as much of that as we could in the film was a great way to underscore that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, a friend of mine said to me yesterday, he said, all art is political. Either you're supporting the status quo or you're questioning and resisting it. So, you know, and you're an artist yourself. And, you know, all of your work is work that sort of allows the viewer to interrogate, you know, what they think about certain systems and situations.
Well, that's a nice way to put it. I never thought of it that way, but yeah, it's a good way to put it.
Yeah. Well, it's been really wonderful talking to
you.
Yeah,
likewise. Thank you.
Yeah, I want to see the cinema, you know, the what did you call the longer version?
The feature, yeah, the festival version. It'll be that'll be on iTunes eventually and Amazon. Like I said, go to our Facebook page for Before the Spring, After the Fall. It has always updated information, and also the Insurgent Media site will have updated information. They were the producers, or the executive producers, I should say, of the show.
Okay.
Thank you so much for having me on. Please check it out. It's on premieres tomorrow night, Sunday night at 10 p.m. Eastern on the World Channel. If you go to worldchannel.org or pbs.org, you can use their various tools to determine which number it is on the dial. And hopefully people get to see it and enjoy it and, think about or get inspired by the stories in the film. That's my hope.
Sure. Oh, yeah, I'm sure people will be inspired. And congratulations on in advance on this new work. And perhaps we can have you
Thank you.
Again, to talk about your film that you're working on presently.
Great. I'd love to come back and do that.
You can't tell about Israel and Palestine. It sounds really intriguing, the 10 questions.
Yeah. You have to wait and find out. I'm up to about 35, and I got to narrow it down. So that's the process of the film.
Oh my, that sounds fun.
Yeah.
All right, you Definitely. Take good care.
Okay, thank you so much for having me on, Wanda. It's been a real pleasure.
Oh, you're welcome. Bye. Peace.
Okay, take
love.
Care. Bye bye.
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 Well, we don't have any of this wonderful music to play this time, so we're going to end with a piece from Meglit Hadaro. let's see, I think we'll play Meglit and Quinn. Look What the Light Did. I like that. You know, there's the camera light and lighting up, issues and enlightenment. So we're going to end with this piece.